I guess we missed each other when Burning Houses came out, but I can see that you have not been idle over the past 2 years. I think I talked to you when you had a little book of poems.
That's right, and No Diamonds, No Honey.
That's right.
You talked to me in.
That's right. Yes.
The novel, didn't you talk? And Ladakh, you talked to me about?
Well, I talked to you when you did Ladakh. I interviewed you when you did One Last Mirror.
That's right.
And I also talked to you.
One Last Mirror and the book of poems came out at the same time.
Ah, well, we talked.
Yes, I remember it well.
Yeah. Well, you obviously you've been busy since that time, so fill me in on all the things you've been
doing. Well, I've been living in Paris. That's the big change since I last saw you. And out of my time in Paris have come these two novels, which are two parts of a trilogy, which I hope I'll finish, God willing, this year. The books begin, at least, in Paris, and they're centered around this aging transvestite film director, Adolf, who's a very famous, very bad film director, a great wit, a great hysteric, a great lover of human beings, and he lives in the Place Saint-Sulpice, in a house that overlooks that most baroque of churches. And so what I've really been doing is enjoying my life in Paris, and out of that enjoyment creating these books. That I find Paris a wonderful place to meditate on things in. It's both worldly and solitary, very cherishing and nourishing of artists, and also very grandiose. It's a perfect city to do the kind of work that I'm doing at the moment in. And I have a small white room in Paris, just as the character in The Web does, which I keep. It's my great extravagance in life. I keep it all the year round, so I feel I have somewhere in the world which is mine. I've always wanted to live in Paris, and now living there gives me a great sense of freedom. And I think the freedom that I hope is in the books, the wit and the expansiveness and the sense of bringing together all the different sides of my life, of India and America, as well as Paris, is from the experience of living in Paris. Paris has always been very friendly to its exiles. It's a good place to reimagine the world in. So that's fundamentally what I've been doing.
Well, I'd like to ask you some questions about Paris in a moment, but first, we have basically in both The Web and Burning Houses three characters that you develop in some detail. Tell me about these three, in addition to the aging transvestite film director. You have two other characters. Tell me about the makeup of these individual characters.
Well, the person who narrates the three books is called Charles. He's a young English writer who lives in Paris. He's in his early 30s. He's had a fairly burnt and strange life and has ended up in Paris. His best friend is Anna, who is also English but has lived in Paris longer than he has. She's in her late 30s, early 40s. She's done many things. She's been a songwriter. She's worked in the fashion business. She's been a hanger-on of the half-glittering worlds in Paris. But she and he share a passion for Indian things, for Indian spirituality, and a search, a quest to find meaning to their lives. And they're both great friends of Adolf, the film director. So these books are about their friendships as they gather strength and revelation, and about the lives that each of them have had and led, and each of them have and lead separately, but also together. I love the combination of three people, because three very different voices can continually mingle and challenge each other. I love writing about friendship, because friendship, unlike passion, takes place in talk and meals and exchange of the soul, really. And so they're all people who have a very deep sense of each other's personality and a deep belief for each other and a deep love of each other. So that the books are really about their friendship as it grows.
And in The Web, the interrelationship of these characters and what they do, that's reflected in a series of letters that they exchange.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
What happens in The Web is that they each go on separate journeys, which turn out to be heading in a very strange way to the same conclusion, to the same insight. Charles goes to look for an old lover who has escaped from an asylum in America. Anna goes back to India, where she'd been in the late part of the 60s. And Adolf goes on his journey of dying, the journey of dying that begins in Burning Houses but takes on new dimensions in The Web. And they go on these separate journeys only to find that very strange incidents happen to each of them, which reveal that they are really on the same quest, headed towards the same destination. In fact, as the book ends, they're headed towards meeting this girl who incarnates the principle of divine femininity, cosmic energy, that they've all been in some way searching for. So I called it the web because I feel that life is, in fact, a web of coincidences, a web of events, a web of insights. They are a web, their friendship is a web, the things that happen to them are a web. The novel, of course, itself is a web of incidents and of character, and the web has at its center this young girl who is an incarnation. And the third part will be about how their experience goes into yet another dimension, how their friendship takes on yet another strangeness when they're actually face to face with her, and then what happens. I wish I knew, but I'm going to try and find out soon.
It'll be easier when you get your computer.
Yes, it will.
Well, it's the web you work in wherever you can. I noticed that Charles' ex-lover, for example, I believe he has drawn webs with faces as a child. I guess he did.
Absolutely.
That, didn't he?
It was something that, in fact, I did as a child. And I spend a lot of time looking at children's paintings because I think that very often they're amazing. It's amazing how often the circle, the sun, the web, the spider comes into. There's something very primal in the image of the spider and in the image of the spider's web. I think it's an old, in the Upanishads, it's said that the universe itself is a web spun out of the body of God. The image of the web, Eliade in one of his anthropological works shows how in each culture the image of the web has been one of the most fundamental images to refer to time, events, history, the actual body of the cosmos itself. So these images go very deep in the psyche.
Now you are presently working on the third part in this trilogy, is that correct? It's not finished.
Well, I've finished it twice, but been so horror-struck at what I've actually done that I'm scrapped both versions, so now I'm going back to reimagine it all. Because I've set myself an enormous problem in the third part. I've got them all to India. India's an extremely difficult place to write about. It's the place I care about most, and I spent all my childhood in. And I suppose for that reason is the place I feel very much that I must get right, whatever right mean. And also I have to introduce this young girl who is, they believe, an incarnation. And to write about an incarnation has its great technical problems. How do you write about somebody that you think is God? What would that person be like? So I've set myself very difficult problems, as I'm sure the reviewers will point out. But I think to overcome those problems, in my experience, you can only overcome real problems by getting into a very light-hearted and playful mood about them, because that's when they solve themselves. If you take them very seriously, which is what I've been doing, they become very, very viscous. It's difficult to do them. So I'm trying to get into the light-hearted frame to do them.
Is that, I just wonder, is that really possible when you write yourself into a box, let's say, don't you become angry and frustrated? I mean, I sometimes have pictures of frustrated writer wadding up paper in a ball, throwing it on the floor. You see the cartoons like that. Doesn't that happen?
Oh, that does happen, but I think it's the same as in life. So many of the breakthroughs in writing come from letting things breathe, letting things be, sometimes not doing things, allowing the problem to go into a back part of the mind, and then suddenly the solution comes. And the solution is always different from any solution you've imagined. It's a different angle, or it's a different voice, or it's writing a scene comically instead of tragically. It's a different approach that reveals the new possibility.
But you're not under a deadline, are you?
No, and I've produced a book a year, and next year I shall have a book of poems come out, but I've left myself a space for the third part because it's so important to me. I must get it right. Obviously, for writing a trilogy, the third part is the one that really brings everything else together. And I've lived so much since. My books reflect not so much my autobiography, but they reflect very much my gathering spiritual awareness and spiritual experience of the world. And it's changed so much since I wrote The Web. I've been through many things since then, spiritually. And I'm trying to find the language to put them all down.
You have been through many things? Is that what you said?
Yes, I've been through many things.
For example,
it's so difficult to talk about these things, but I've been travelling a great deal in India again, and I've been taking very seriously the meditation side of my life. And I wrote a book on Ladakh, which was the story of my encounter with a Tibetan priest. And I think because I have been practicing for 10 years, I mean, however badly and stupidly, I feel closer to the realities that I only once new guest aunt. And the world becomes stranger and stranger as you become closer to those relatives. It's very difficult to describe what you see in even very advanced stages of meditation.
How do you characterize the homosexual elements in the web? This would not be a book that would be attractive per se to the homosexual community, would it?
I don't think so. I don't think it's... My own feeling about homosexual and heterosexuality is that it really is, and it's it's whether you love that's important. It's not so much what you love or what sex you love. I'm not writing homosexual books. I'm writing, in a way, religious books. I think, though, that the theme of homosexuality is quite important, because I have a feeling that homosexuals have been very stupidly written about. It's not just because it's either they've been victims and the tortured victims, or they've been sexual athletes. Both seem to me very boring. I think there's another way of looking at homosexuals, that they're sometimes guardians of a particular kind of spiritual consciousness. The American Indians called them Berdashes and gave them a very grand position in their society, and they were very honored because sharing in the male and the female psyche as they did, they could be mediators between the divine and the material. And in fact, in the third part, I've given the main burden of my trilogy to this aging transvestite for a reason, because he is, in a way, a kind of shaman, a magician, somebody who moves easily between categories, who isn't condemned to be one identity or another, a great master of illusion and a magician. And I think that there is a great deal to be learnt from all transformations of gender, because we mustn't be imprisoned in any gender. There's so much to be learned from the masculine and the feminine sides of our psyche.
We mustn't be imprisoned in any gender?
We mustn't be imprisoned in any definition of gender, I think. Because if you're a man, there's so much to be learned from the feminine side of your psyche, whether you're not your homosexual. There's so much to be learned about love, about sensitivity, about motherhood in the largest sense, about being nourishing and nurturing. And if you're a woman, there's so much to be learned from the male side of your psyche, whether or not you actively express it in a lesbian way, I think.
What do your Tibetan influences have to say about that?
Oh, they, in Indian and Tibetan thought, absolutely, the polarity between masculine and feminine, the marriage of those two things is stressed again and again and again. The enlightened person, in a way, is the androgyne, the person who's combined the man and the woman within themselves, who is no longer belongs to any sex, but has transcended them both, the limitations of both. I think that's a very, very strong streak of androgyny in Hinduism. And in fact, some of the Hindu gods are shown half women and half masculine. For example, Shiva is half male and half female in one of his manifestations. And the Hinduism plays at its deepest mystical levels with the merging of the male and the female inside the soul. That's what Tantra philosophy is in a way about.
Probably hard to walk that way.
It's true. Hard to do anything.
Where were you living before you moved to Paris?
I was living in England, and thank God I stopped that. Because Thatcher's England is a rather depressing place, I can tell you.
In London?
I was living in Oxford. But I was always travelling a lot. Mm-hmm. And I wanted very much to find a place where I would settle down, because my problem is that I am incurably restless, and I long to find a place where... And so the other problem was that England is a fish pond, a village, and if you live there too long, everybody knows much too much about you. And I don't mean that I've done terrible things that I don't want, but it's nice to live in a place in which you are anonymous and quiet, and you go and sit in a cafe and nobody knows who you are and that kind of thing.
New York has that to offer as well, I think, doesn't it?
I enjoyed my times in New York, but New York is not a place that writers, in my experience, feel very much. I think if you're a singer or an actor or a model or a film star, New York, because it's a very high, glamorous place. But for writers, I haven't found it very conducive to writing. I did write One Last Mirror in a basement in New York, so I have done writing here. But there's something about the atmosphere of New York that doesn't really make you feel that you have any right to exist as a writer. It's not a very glamorous thing. It's a slow, patient, weird thing that goes on underground. And New York seems more excitable.
Well, most writers of note have given New York a shot at one point or another.
Oh, yes. Well, you can't not have New York in your life as a writer, because so much of your career is centered in New York. And maybe I'll have the courage one day. I think I'd have to be you have to be pretty strong to take on a New York subject as a European writer. But I feel I know very many different aspects of New York now, and maybe I would like to. There is a New York scene in the web. Quite a bit of the web is set in New York, actually. But it's not very flattering to New York, that particular thing.
Well, New York doesn't need to be built up.
No.
I was reading a while back about, I guess it was in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, with this whole new substrata of writers that include Tamara Janowitz and
David Levitt,
and Jay McInerney was one of them. And as I read it, though, it turned out that these writers actually knew each other really only in passing. A couple of them worked together or shared houses together or something like that, but a lot of them really didn't know each other. But they're grouped as New York writers, and a lot of them have actually moved out, and yet they're still seen as part of this young... Yeah,
they meet together for lunch and things, and they often show the same agents and the same publishers. I don't think there's a real New York group. I think that is really a media creation. It's not in the same way as there was a Parisian group, for example, in the 20s, where people really took endless holidays together, knew each other extremely well, and loved each other very much.
You find Paris a hospitable place? The French have this, there's a feeling about the French that they are not warm to outsiders.
Well, you must speak their language. I suppose I do speak their language, and so therefore they like that. I find them, they've got the right mixture for me of hospitality and indifference. I don't mind them being indifferent in a certain way, because it means that you can crawl from stone to stone without being trod on. I find it's a very strangely peaceful city, Paris, to live in. It's an old world city, it's old fashioned. It's not noisy and violent. Well, of course, there have been these bombings. And that's what I like about it, too, because it's a city in which your thoughts are not, can develop something. A novelist is a very strange creature. I think novel is a very strange act. It's a very solitary act, when you're writing a novel, you have to, as you know, you follow your thoughts endlessly into strange corners. And I find a city like Paris perfect for that, because in its structure even it is like the brain, with these secret corridors and these doors that open onto courtyards you didn't suspect were there. And walking around Paris has for me the feeling of walking around my imagination, or at least as I would like my imagination to be, full of crannies and nooks and secret courtyards. It's a magical place.
It's nice to share Paris with all those literary ghosts as well.
Very. And so I live in the seventh. I have a small place in the seventh, so that I live around the corner from Colette and sometimes see her in dreams. I live around the corner from Racine. And Jacques Brel wanders singing up and down my street. I feel very, very close to the people. I love French writing. There's something about the French genius that, especially if you're writing mystical religious work, as I am, the great danger of that is to become extremely highfalutin and metaphysical. And Paris is so earthy and so down to earth and so, in a way, unconcerned with the religious, that it's a very good reminder for me to root whatever I'm thinking about right in the world and in the stones and in the light. And the great French writers are such masters of the worldly. Like Colette, for example, is a great French favorite of mine.
I understand that one of the top-rated television broadcasts is on Friday evenings, and it's only about books.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. I forget his name. It'll come back to me in a fact. But he's, in fact, one of the most powerful men in France. Apostrophe. And the guy's name is George something. Oh, he's wonderful. The French idea of a talk show is that you invite somebody on to the talk show and then talk all the time and not let them get a word in edgeways, which is what he does. So he invites the great French intellectuals on, and they sit there apoplectic and silent while he tells them what they've written. And France loves this. I love it too, because it's very funny and he's very clever. But it's great to think of a culture that takes its literature seriously enough to offer prime time to someone.
Yeah, it's very difficult in this country to get a broadcast about books on, even if it's off time.
Absolutely.
Very difficult.
Well, perhaps
there aren't
Johnny Carson
any, really.
Should take up reading.
What's that?
Perhaps Johnny Carson should take up reading, and he would have something.
That would destroy his image.
That's true. It
wouldn't be the same. You are still teaching here in the States, aren't
Yes,
you?
I very much love having... I spent 3 months, a year in the States. I'm also a literary editor of Normal, which is a magazine that Rizzoli is bringing out quarterly now. and is based in the States and based in New York. So therefore, the States plays an enormous part of my life. I feel very committed to what's going on in America.
Do you have a culture shock when you come to the States?
Well, I did at the beginning, because I came for the first time to the States after a year in India, so it was really seeing the two sides of the world, and it took me a long time to understand, or begin to understand the States. It's a very mysterious, very violent, very strange place for an outsider. I think probably for Americans, too. I don't think I understand anymore. I think it becomes more and more mysterious to me. I feel very moved by the States and very disturbed by what's going on at present.
What do you mean by mysterious?
Well, there's so many different Americas. There are so many different strands in America, so many different races, so many different realities that coexist. If you walk down a New York street, you can meet an aging Russian countess, a bag lady, a young yuppie, an old man singing to himself, a fading opera singer. The whole world is here, and all jostling together. I love the fact that when somebody once told me that Dustin Hoffman and Horowitz lived in the same block, but that symbolizes the kind of mad juxtapositions that the State specializes in for me. I also think that the money and greed, people always say they're very crude appetites, but in fact they are crude appetites, but they have very strange manifestations. You see how they work and how the ego works.
I was reading a book some time ago about America's entry into the First World War, and when the Americans were sent to Europe, they marched into London, and they were greeted as heroes, of course, coming over there to help fight the Kaiser. And the British thought, well, all these Americans were just like themselves. And as the Americans' troops dispersed, they found that they had German names, and they had Polish names, and there were blacks, and all of the traditional white Anglo-Saxons that the British expected to come marching back through the streets, they were in a minority. The Americans weren't the same thing.
I love that. I mean, my father's half Indian, so all my life I've been brought up with this foreign blood, and in England as a child that was sort of damaging. I love the fact that America is this melting pot, and I love the fact that I teach kids with Polish and backgrounds, with black backgrounds, and all sorts of backgrounds. It makes for a very potentially a very energetic and exciting community. I think it's dampened horribly by media and all sorts of forces that destroy that, but potentially America's the most exciting place in the world.
The English do have a reputation of being contemptuous of other races and religions.
Rightly so.
Well, I was shocked when I was reading Paul Theroux's book, the one, I can't remember the name
Coasting.
Of it.
Coasting. No, that's
no, it was the one in which walked around the island. Kingdom by the Sea, yeah. Where in everyday language people would say Jew boy or nigger.
That's horrifying.
And
well, don't forget the English.
This is not allowed here, actually. In some areas, some redneck areas, you might hear it, but in general, it's just not done in every common everyday speech.
I'm struck by that. I'm struck, too, that there's a great deal of tolerance in this country. Of course, there is a great deal of violence and everything, but there is an enormous amount of tolerance and humour. Otherwise, the country couldn't function at all. I think England has always been terribly racist and very prejudiced. It just was able to get away with it when it had international power. It could enforce its own prejudice and make it seem like the law of being. And it did so over most of the world. I held no brief for England, I can assure you.
And yet,
that's why I've lived abroad from it for so long, and I spend most of my life in Paris.
What you say, it's not a state discrimination in the way that some of these southern states in the United States, for example, more than a quarter of a century ago, actually had laws that were similar to those in South Africa. But I don't believe Britain has ever had anything like that.
It just oppressed them. When you're ruling a country, you can exclude them from everything. You don't have a law. You don't need laws to exclude them. You just exclude them. If I was ruling New York, I could choose who I wanted to do what. That's what the British did for half of the world for a bit. You don't need laws. You just need power.
Well, Andrew Harvey, it was great seeing you, having you back. The web, of course, is masterfully written. You haven't lost your touch, nor are you likely to. I'll look forward to reading the third book when it comes out, and when you finally work out that ending
on your
new computer.
Well, I wish you would help me. I'm sure the computer... Perhaps I should ask the computer, because everything else seems to be jamming at the moment.
No, I won't write it for you.
You won't write it for
me? It won't write it for you.
No, it won't. Maybe we soon have computers that will write things for us, though, if we tell them and talk to them in that way. No,
they say computers are dumb. You have to program them. Sometimes they take over, but they're not that smart.
What about that computer in 2001? He wasn't dumb. I think there's some computers which they're not telling us about, which are much more luminous and intelligent than we are. I hope so.
Andrew Harvey, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.